Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today I'm very pleased indeed to welcome back to the programme Andy and Mel Jennings of the brilliant Christian indie rock band Dissident Prophet, which for long-term listeners to TMR, well, need no introduction whatsoever, since we've had previous interviews with them, first with Andy, and then indeed with the whole band when they came on to introduce their previous album, Red Moon Rising. But I guess there's going to be some people out there who are not familiar with Dissident Prophet, so in a few minutes I shall ask them if they will to give us a brief introduction. But first let me say, Mel and Andy, thanks ever so much for coming on the show again.
Hi, Julian. Good to speak again, man.
Hi there. Pleasure.
Hello, hello. It is great to be speaking with you again after quite a while since that last album came out. But of course, today we're going to be speaking about your new album, which we'll mention in a few minutes. But do you want to give us, for those people who do not know you, give us some kind of introduction, just a brief introduction to what the band is about?
Yeah, we've been going about 25 years. We formed in the early 90s and we were signed to a label in those days, a secular label. And after 3 years, we went on our own, and we've just been making music ever since. We are a Christian band, in a sense, but we don't really fit into the mold of the mainstream Christian music scene. Yeah, I guess that's really, we've been carrying on doing it. We've not sought to kind of be heavily exposed or spread wide, but we've just plodded on, kept writing songs as they come, really. That's it.
Well, I mean, I've always enjoyed your music hugely and your lyrics. You know, I think it's absolutely fantastic what you do, as people who have listened to the previous interviews will know. And this album, which you have now, it's not actually come out yet, has it? But it will do in a week or two from now, something like that, seems to be continuing the same standard that you have set for yourselves. This is called Strange Days, although, as you know, I called it Strange Times the other week when I mentioned it in a podcast. I do apologise for that. So we're going to be talking about this particular album today. Do you want to tell us why you called it Strange Days?
I mean, I guess it's because we noticed the strangeness of the times we're living in has just ramped up a bit with all the developments in technology, developments in media, the developments in propaganda, the speed at which things are changing culturally, a bit like we're not in Kansas anymore, a bit like from the Wizard of Oz. Things that seem to be kind of reasonable and understandable and straightforward seem to have been rejected for a kind of postmodern relativist strange world. We're kind of on the yellow brick road heading towards the Emerald City to see the Wizard of Oz, not knowing, of course, that it's just a bloke behind a curtain. Things are not as they were. That's why we call it Strange Days, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. You know? I mean, something of this came over in your recent podcast. You've got this, what was your podcast called? Is it Not So Dissident Future, something like that?
Yeah, The Not So Dissident Future. Yeah, Mel and I do that every week or so. Kind of based on a song that we've done and how it relates to the times we're living in. Yeah.
Yeah. So your recent episode, which was to do with outcome-based education and all the issues surrounding that. Mel, from your experience as a teacher, you were saying how much of education has changed through the decades that you've been teaching and how things seem very strange now, the way education is approached in comparison with how it was when you first started.
Yeah.
That's just one aspect of the way things have changed.
Yeah, it's undergone a transformational change over the years, certainly recent decade or two. And its terminology has renamed itself. So what is education now? And what is a teacher now is a facilitator. You know, what is learning is about how they learn rather than what they learn. You know, it's undergone a huge change, and it's a lot of it's to do with global citizenship now and things like that. So that's one example of the way in which, under our very eyes, really, we're assuming we grow up, become parents, and we send our kids off to school just like we went to school. But there's been a paradigm shift, really, in what it's all about.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've tasted a bit of that. Obviously, we've had our children, they're all kind of grown up adults now, but we've seen them go through the process. And, you know, some of the things they were taught to do, you know, we read about some of the changes that have taken place in education and the roots where that's come from, like the United Nations with Robert Mueller and his connections with Alice Bailey, which is kind of New Age philosophy. And then, of course, your kid comes home and tells you that they had to meditate in class and imagine themselves to be a god. Maybe draw a picture of what kind of God they were. And they're also asked to kind of meditate, close their eyes and imagine looking at the earth as God. So, you know, it rubber hits the road. You know, we can all theorize about this stuff and say, oh dear, isn't it terrible what could happen? But when your kid actually comes home and they're actually kind of telling you what they're being asked to do and you think, oh, it's actually happening.
Right. So that's actually speaking from your own experience in your own family.
Yes, yes. And of course, and our kids are both, I think our youngest, both watched the Al Gore propaganda Inconvenient Truth twice in a school assembly. So education is more about agendas rather than actual learning. You know.
Well, of course, I connect with that idea that the current days are rather strange, because, of course, that's one of the main reasons why the Mind Renewed exists. Mm. You know, I was looking at the world like anyone else, trying to understand it, and often finding that it didn't quite fit the ways I was brought up to expect it to be. And, of course, the big one for me, and I know for a lot of people, was what happened on 9/11. You know, the world did seem to become increasingly strange thereafter, and so I felt it was necessary to try to understand what was going on from a Christian worldview perspective.
Mm.
And I know you see that growing strangeness in terms of biblical prophecy, in the sense that, you know, we might expect to see the days become odder as we approach the end of the end times. And no doubt elements of biblical prophecy will crop up later in our conversation. But turning to the song Strange Days itself, from which, of course, the album takes its name, you do specifically reference 9/11, don't you?
Yes. I mentioned that, you know, we saw the towers crashing down, you know, on the way to the Emerald City, kind of like on the yellow brick road towards a new world order, or this brave new world, as it were. As you're walking along the yellow brick road, you look across and you see the towers coming down. These are kind of like signposts towards the new world order, in a sense. I know that's become a tired phrase just because it's a meme, it's out there. Nevertheless, it's still true. There are people who are parroting that, and people in very high places saying we need a new world order. And even social justice warriors, the youth that have gone through this educational system, this outcome-based education, they are probably going to be the people calling for a new world order. The people who are out on the streets with their hammers and sickle scarves, they're the ones who are probably going to say, we need a new order, you know, calling for the Pied Piper to come and take them away, you know.
Well, maybe so. As your lyrics go, strange days, no black, no white. Strange days, no wrong, no right. No dark, no light, when 2 + 2 = 5. Which I'm reading as that postmodern turn, you know, that extreme postmodernism anyway, that eats away at the notion of truth. I can well see that people who have no absolutes by which to judge truth from error are going to be easy prey for those who might want to manipulate them further down the road, as I discussed in that series of interviews with Tom Gailey. And later in the song, I noticed that you referenced the occultist Aleister Crowley. Now, why does he get a mention?
We've referenced Crowley a couple of times. Strange Days is not just about political turmoil or the reformation of a global economic system and things like that. It is a transformational thing that takes place in the minds of men. The popular culture that Crowley pushed in that Pied Piper way was to transform the people's thinking, because that's where the real transformational magic, you know, M-A-G-I-C-K, that Crowley might talk about, takes place, you know. So that's why we're living in these strange days. It's something that will affect people's way of thinking. You know, before it might have affected the way we spoke. You know, people have talked about political correctness and what you can and can't say and things like that. But terms are getting redefined now so that we're really being censored in our minds as well. You know, what was perhaps considered a left-wing thing, which, you know, people have thought of being liberal or something, has somehow morphed as a movement into something that's quite aggressive and intolerant and, you know, one might also say fascist in the way it manifests itself. And then the right has been redefined, you know, from its classical liberalist position to being something else. So these terms are being turned up on their heads, and children are growing up as Hitler knew, if you're able to get the youth, if you're able to educate the next generation, they'll educate the parents anyway, and you get this transformational thing. But the Strange Days element of our album, it touches on all these things, really, but in particular the way minds are being changed and thoughts and opinions.
I'm interested to know what you're thinking in terms of who it is who is changing the minds. I mean, you mentioned there Aleister Crowley. Presumably, you don't put all of this down to this one man. So how does he fit into this picture, and who are they, as it were, who are trying and have been trying to change the minds of men?
Well, I think there's always been a hermetic order. Like, there's always been an ancient mystery, the mystery religions. I mean, really, all that Crowley did was just, there's nothing new he did. It was just reinvigorating the mystery religions. And there is a select group of people on planet Earth that do have a plan for the Earth, as sci-fi as that might sound, that there are secret organizations. And they do have a belief. They do have a theology. They're not just a bunch of guys. I mean, I guess there are people who are there for money and power. But there are people with a dream, I believe. I mean, they have a deity. They are loyal to it. They believe that their God will bless them. Mm. But that it's a secret. It's a special one where you're initiated, and it's for only a certain few. It's not for everyone. That contrasts massively with the gospel of Jesus Christ, which is for everyone, and it's no secret. It's open. It's really straightforward and bare. It's the gospel, and it seems foolishness to people because it's so simple, and God's achieved such great things for mankind to save him and have eternal life and all those things. But I believe there's an opposite, a counterpoint to that, which the enemy very cleverly has devised, the religiousness to the New World Order, not just business and economics and stuff.
And I think the Crowley thing just kind of caught our imagination, really, at the time when we were doing the album. And it really just focuses on this transformation in popular culture, which is through music and entertainment. And we are in this information age, and people love their entertainment and their music. You know, festivals are the new big thing, aren't they? They're also transformational.
Transformational, yes. Yes, yes. I mean, I think I see what you mean. But when it comes to these sort of transformational, oneness, new agey sorts of ideas, I do tend to think more of things like Marilyn Ferguson's book, The Aquarian Conspiracy. And of course, I think she's using the word conspiracy there in a slightly ironic way, because the way it's presented in the book is that this is a way of thinking that a lot of people share. So this is 1980, something like that, in all sorts of walks of life. So in education, and in business, and in health, and in self-development, and all this. And the idea was that all those people around the world sharing this way of looking at the world would network and therefore work together. That's the conspiracy element, but it's an open conspiracy to change the world. So I do see there's that kind of thing that has been going on and still is going on. But that's open. That's not the secret society thing, although no doubt there's a connection there. But I tend to think of what you were saying, Andy, about, you know, this is a spiritual conspiracy. You know, Satan is opposed to God's purposes and does want to change the minds of human beings, of course, to think the way that he would have people think.
Yeah.
So I tend to think of the conspiracy against God and against humanity as being centered there. That's the headquarters, as it were. And so that gets worked out in the world by these spiritual entities influencing people's minds internally and directly, so as to produce these oneness philosophies and cultural movements and the like, and to make people susceptible to them. And so therefore, I do question how much of this is down to the influence of specific secret societies. I mean, I don't doubt their existence or that they have influence, but I wonder how much of this is really being directed by such people. And I question that they have as much power and influence as is often ascribed to them.
I guess it's a bit of both. I would imagine the fallen nature of us as man means that we're open to it anyway. We have a propensity to being deceived and to plans that aren't godly and to working it out ourselves. Plus, there's also a forcing change. Carl Tekeri coined the phrase, but I think that's good because there's a temptation to think that things evolve naturally. This is the way it is, that the New World Order is just a natural progression. But actually, if you do some homework, you know, organizations, let's say this Council for Foreign Relations or something, or the Trilateral Commission and various other globalist organizations, they are forcing change. They have a plan and they see it as their kind of divine mission to bring these things about. Many of them, of course, will die before they even see the fruits of their labors. I think there is a spiritual dimension to it and they have a plan.
And the people who occupy some of these high up positions, the movers and the shakers, you know, in rearranging the golden future that they kind of foresee, you know, they occupy very high positions in law, education, politics. You know, they're not going to walk around doing the Masonic handshake in open sight, but they're all linked up somehow or another. This vast web that you've been describing, Julian, this sort of New Age web, will include everything. If you go to education, you know, Robert Mueller's the one that has sort of downloaded to us the World Core Curriculum, which has become the national curriculum in Britain and other things elsewhere. He takes his inspiration directly from Alice Bailey, who was a theosophist, and you follow her, and she's taken her teachings linked with that Aquarian conspiracy lady to, you know, and to Madame Blavatsky, which is this mixture of Eastern philosophy and occultism and Kabbalah and now we're back to Crowley again. So they're all linked one way or another. You know, you think something as staid as education would be headed by very sensible, down to earth people that aren't at all spiritual in inverted commas, but they are spiritual.
I think we're on the same page, really. It's just a matter of emphasis, because I just think some people do tend to put everything down to these perhaps all coordinated secret groups, and I do think that, you know, that is an exaggeration. Mm. There isn't the evidence to warrant that kind of vision. But as I said to you before, I don't doubt that these people and these organizations exist and that, you know, these influences are there. But I do think there is also a sort of general cultural influence that's happening, as I said before, from spiritual headquarters that is moving things in this direction, and that all these influences are interconnecting and moving forward towards what you were calling the New World Order.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think there's people sitting, ha, 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 we have the plan and we work for the devil and all that kind of stuff. I don't think it's like that. Mm. Probably people with probably really believe it's the right thing to do. People are stupid. They need ruling kind of thing. You know, the Platonic idea that, you know, what do you do about all these different people who...
How do we shepherd the people?
We are the enlightened ones. We've had proper educations, classical ones, and we've also been through all these initiations. We've had a tough time. We have a right to be ruling these idiots. That's the kind of attitude, I think. And they probably think they're doing everyone a favor. Then there's probably other people who just genuinely think it's a good idea to be one and global. And they probably genuinely think nationalism is the problem with the world, or religion is the problem with the world. Mm. And they think, oh, if we only come together as one, you know. Mm. And they probably have the best intentions, even though naive, you know.
Tell you how the West was won, without a bullet from any gun. Just 40 years and we were done. We bought the road on which we hung. They fought a war by other means. They changed their minds and then with TV screens. We closed our eyes and went to sleep. kept us all sane. Opened our minds so much, we lost our brains. We didn't think that we would never be the same.
Another song on the album is Sergeant Pepper, Major Tom, which seems to be about the kind of false promise of a new world, which was in the air in the counterculture scene of the 60s and 70s. And you have in the lyrics here, whatever happened to the golden dawn? The Pied Piper came and played his song. He played the tune and we sang along. Where did the children go to? It didn't turn out so cool. So are you saying a generation was sort of hoodwinked to an extent by this false but attractive and understandable, nevertheless false promise?
Yeah, I mean, it's upsetting. It's horrific, really, because, I mean, there must have been such hope at the time, you know, looking for meaning, you know, people genuinely searching for truth.
Absolutely, yeah.
And we know the Jesus movement came out of that, like the hippies turned to Jesus, and that was a really amazing move of God's spirit. I think a lot of people became Christians who were disillusioned with the esoteric side. Obviously, there were linchpin guys. There were like Lennon, Bowie, Jim Morrison, Page, other people within the music scene, of course, obviously the other people, but within the music scene,
who were very influential,
great talents, great songwriters. They obviously had the blessing of the muses, but it's such a shame because you think, well, what happened? What, there was such hope, but within, by 1969, you know, and Charles Manson and that stuff, it all went kind of sour. And I think, well, where did those people go? Where are the people with the flowers in their hair? What happened to them? Did they go off and become business people? I guess some people who lived in California became, had communes, and when that didn't work, and they probably did something, went into some kind of ethical green thing. I don't know.
Well, you say in the line, where did the dreamers go to? Some died, the others bought suits.
Well, they must have, because they haven't got flowers in their hair, so they are wearing suits. So what became of that hope of the golden dawn? And I just think it's a good lesson to learn that nothing came of it, yet there was such hope, and yet so many people would have been riding on that wave. And it's just good to take note of that.
Yes, I agree. But a lot of that, it seems to me, was coming from a good place. This is one of the things that Francis Schaeffer used to say, that many of the people at the time were reacting against the complacency and materialism of their parents' generation. Parents who, you know, on the surface were saying things like, oh, yes, we're Christian, we're spiritual, but had in many cases given into just the good life and consumerism, materialism. And many of these young people, being very idealistic, were saying, you know, this is no good. And of course, this is the time of the Vietnam War. So, you know, I think a lot of that was coming from the right place. But, you know, as you say, it led in the wrong direction to this cul-de-sac that you describe.
Yeah, I mean, you were saying, it's interesting what you were saying. I do agree with it. It's funny, I was thinking it before you spoke. I was thinking exactly what you were thinking, that it was a good thing to start to look for meaning. A lot of people were genuinely looking for meaning. It just didn't mean they found it. And I'd encourage anyone to start thinking. Yeah, of course, going into experimenting with drugs and all that kind of stuff and everything was obviously going to be not the right way to go about it. But then
I think the human problem goes back to Genesis 3 again, because we search for these ways as fallen beings. We're searching always, of course, we're searching for the right way to organize ourselves, the right sort of government, the right way to conduct our relationships with one another. But it will always result, and what we tend to do is swing from one to the other. We're sheep without a shepherd if we're under the principalities and powers. And every single system of man, if man's trying to make it without God, then it's going to swing, isn't it? Marxism, fascism, and whatever it is, being really materialistic and covetous to living monastical, strange lives of flagellation or whatever. We swing from one to the other. And then the other factor is you've got the evil one who, as you were saying, will not let an opportunity go to waste. So whatever waves of change we're experiencing as a society, he'll jump in and swing us away.
Yeah, I mean, going back to this counterculture thing, I do actually quite identify with that, in the sense that if I was not a Christian, had I not become a Christian, I think I would probably have been still quite enamoured of that countercultural way of life. I mean, I look around the world at the hustle and the bustle, and, you know, I just think it is no good, and I can see why people want to find an alternative way of living. And
absolutely.
And part of me, you know, still is there, except that I have come to believe in Christ. I've got to come to the end of my pride and trust him. And of course, that gives you a different way of looking at things, but it doesn't mean you therefore negate the genuine search that you see that people are engaged in.
No. And you can so understand that young people in general who have that zeal to change the world, and, you know, in a right sense, they have that zeal, they have the energy. Yeah. On the whole, they're kind of left-wing oriented because they're seeing what's happened to capitalism and the greed in the hearts of men and so on. And yeah, we recently watched, you all know him, Julian, he runs the Fuel Project.
Mark Fairley.
I've heard of it, but I don't know him. How about that?
Oh, well,
can recommend a really good series called War on Truth. It's really good.
Okay, I'll look at that.
And in that, he puts his finger on it really clearly and really well, because he divides what he calls the soft virtues and the hard virtues. And soft virtues are things like love and mercy and grace and so on. And as you're saying, in the heart of decent-minded people, the people that you would want to endorse in life, you know, they want these good transformations. They're leaning over and embracing those soft virtues. But the hard virtues, which are things like justice, righteousness, holiness, they also have to be embraced. And they generally veer away from that and don't want those. Those hard virtues are too hard, you know. Maybe they don't understand, obviously they don't understand what holiness is or righteousness is, because that's been redefined, you know. And so Mark Fairley talks really eloquently about God embodies both of those things perfectly. But as human beings, we tend to identify with one set of values or the other. And therein lies the problem, because if we're all for sort of the love side, and we've redefined love and what grace is and mercy and tolerance and all those things, we get ourselves in one pit. On the other hand, if you embrace the hard virtues, you're going to end up in scary places. So mankind is in this horrible juncture of not really being able to combine those two virtues in practice, because only God does that.
Very good point.
Mm-hmm. And you find, unfortunately, that in many of the churches, the mainstream churches, that it's just the love of God, but when it comes to justice and judgment in particular, no, we can't have anything to do with that.
Yeah.
And, you know, when there were phrases that are preached on, like the wrath of God, which actually has, you know, a great theological pedigree, it's a biblical understanding, but of course you do need to go into it to understand exactly what's being said. It's not like human anger. But, you know, when those phrases come out, they're preached or they're in a reading or something like that, then people, you can see, people don't like it. And I've had people say to me, or like, I can't accept that God is wrathful because God is a God of love. And I'm thinking, well, those two things don't actually contradict each other. You just haven't thought about it enough. You just imbibe the spirit of the age that says, oh, well, it's all about softness, the hard things. Well, we don't like those.
Right.
There isn't much thought involved with this at all. So I can see that happening in the churches, and I think it's very unfortunate.
On the other hand, of course, you have those who only focus on the justice, righteousness, holiness, wrath,
sure,
and have real difficulty with grace and mercy. And what's so wonderful, you see, is Jesus, because he embodies the whole thing. You see, when you read the Gospels, you think, oh, I've got the nice Jesus here, gracious and merciful, help a guy out, you know, who's in need. And then you've got the other guy who's turning over the tables, calling some people really serious names and talking about wrath. And people pick and mix, you know.
They do.
I can't fully understand righteousness, but I think we have to work to understand God's righteousness, how righteous he is, because then you'll understand how merciful and how gracious he is. And sometimes if we try and make him less righteous, we make him less merciful and gracious in a way. It's an equation that has to balance.
I find it really interesting that, you know, Jesus somehow amazingly embodied these two. How can love be satisfied and how can justice be satisfied? And I think mankind throughout the ages, you know, when you're talking about the Sumerians, the Egyptians, the Greeks, whoever it is, as we got more and more towards the time of Jesus, you know, you can almost imagine they're scratching their heads, Plato and all these Greek philosophers saying, how can this come about? How can we bring about this society? Plato has his idea of the Republic, which is flawed, but he was asking the right questions and everything. And you can see that it would seem a miraculous thing. How can these two things be satisfied? And I think it's one of those like lateral thinking questions. And then Jesus comes along. It's like, ah, there it is. There it is.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you see it there on the cross. You know,
yeah.
There is this act of love and mercy. And yet he's hanging there on the cross because of what each one of us has done wrong in our lives. And of course, some people can't get their heads around that, because they're thinking, well, that was 2,000 odd years ago. How does that relate to me?
Mm-hmm.
But of course, God is outside of time as we experience it. And he sees what we're going to do in the future. He sees everything. And so therefore, it does relate to each one of us. It's done in complete knowledge of who we are and what we've done.
Yeah.
But you see that combined on the cross. It's the most astonishing symbol.
Astonishing.
Of the very heart of God there on the cross. It's amazing.
He was cut off for 3 hours, and we can't understand this because we're not God, but between the Father and the Son, that break had to happen so that we could come into a relationship with God. Look, there's a little example. When we adopted our son, I mean, my eldest son is Mel's natural son. For a couple of minutes when we went to court, Mel actually gave up her natural rights to being the dad.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm getting confused with all the gender talk these days.
I'll leave that one in. Yeah, go on.
She had to give up for a few minutes before the gavel went down her natural parenthood to Dan. And then the judge hit the gavel and said, right, okay, now it's done. So she and I adopted Dan, but she didn't have to. He was naturally hers. But she gave up that right so that she could adopt him back. And it's like that with Jesus. He gave up his relationship with his Father for a few hours so that we could come in and have that. And I just find that absolutely amazing. And I can't get my head around it, because it's something obviously we can't look into in a way in depth, because it's between the Father and the Son.
Well, this is why there are so many theories of the atonement, you know, and each one of them, as has been said many, many times, that each one of them has some aspect of truth about it, you know, rather like a diamond with different faces upon it. And, you know, if we concentrate on one to the exclusion of all the others, we're probably missing something there.
Mm.
But I mean, this is one of the things I love about Christianity, that it is historically rooted. It's not like philosophy, that you start with first principles and you work out what your theory is. It's rather, this has happened. This is a person who went through these experiences, and now, probably beginning with Paul, you know, we're left in the position of trying to make sense of this, and that goes on and on. And
right.
I love the way around that is, because it's rooted, it's real, it's not coming from human beings to start with. God does it. We're left with then trying to work it out. But we are left with propositions that apply to us, you know. Jesus has died. Jesus has died for us and because of us. And if we place faith in what he has done, however we understand that, mm-hmm. our sins are forgiven. And I just love the way that God initiates that rather than it coming from us. Again, it's not humanistic. It's theistic. It's he who has done it.
So he's on the front foot. He is pursuing us.
Yes.
And I suppose that's in the sense that you'd think of God in that sense being masculine because it's a pursuing nature. We know there's aspects of him that are feminine, not that he's either of them, but yeah. You know, he's on the front foot. He's actually pursuing a bride. He's pursuing us, yes. even when we're not even asking. So he's like, he's done this, now go discuss, you know, work yeah, it out, right. but I've done it.
Is there something of this in that song, Everybody Knows?
Yeah.
You're saying that everybody knows, you know, there's something wrong with the world, yeah. obviously, and something's going to happen, something's coming. But is there a sense also of everybody deep down knows that God exists and God is just?
I think there is that, even if it's tenuous in some cases. But I agree. I speak to a lot of guys and stuff in my job and probation and whatever, and it's very interesting. Initially, people put up a real kind of barrier. But then as time goes on, you realize they have thought about these things, you know. Yeah. I mean,
and there is that line at the end. Julian's already sort of referred to Francis Schaeffer. You know, you've taken that from Francis Schaeffer, haven't you? The line of despair.
The line of despair, yeah.
I thought it might be. That was going to be my next question, actually. And the line of despair is waiting. It waits for you to fall, yeah.
So it's a very tenuous existence. We know something's up with the world, you know, even if you watch the media, you know. But there's something wrong and we don't kind of want to know it. We want to just kind of stay comfortable, understand it. You know, we want to stay in the sheep pen. But nevertheless, we still know something ain't right. And I guess when things happen to us personally that go wrong, that's when we think about it a little bit more. And it's an opportunity sometimes to consider the line of despair. What is the point? What is the meaning? Now, I meet people in my other job, my mental health job, who've been very successful people, entrepreneurs, millionaires and stuff. And then they've suddenly just hit a wall. You know, they're very successful in the world and they've suddenly hit the wall and they've broken down, don't know what the point of life is, and they start thinking about it, you know.
Is that why you have kind of two different styles in the song? So when you have the verse, it's more sort of, I mean, it starts off acoustic, quiet, these sort of seesawing chords. I don't know what key it's in, but if it was in E flat, it's like for musos out there, sort of an E flat plus seven.
It's a C sharp, chord, actually, and, yeah. C sharp.
Oh, it's a C sharp. Yeah. It's a C sharp. Okay. And so then the next chord would be, if you said C sharp, then it would be a B flat.
B flat, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So, and it sort of seesaws back and forth between those in this really quiet acoustic way. And then it becomes a lot louder when you get to, but everybody knows that something's wrong, etc.
Yeah.
Is that the brick wall that you're talking about? Everything going along, trundling along, but then actually things are not okay.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, also because we get up every morning and do the things we do, jobs and whatever, go about our business, the normal kind of hamster cage daily routine. And then occasionally something will confront us, a conversation or so, you know, someone talks about God at work today or something, upset me, you know, or whatever, or something happened on the news and it was really upsetting and why did this happen? And, you know, and then we'll kind of, I'll block that out and carry on with my routine, you know, kind of thing. We've got a park near us and it's just sitting on the bench looking at the park and there's a train that goes past and there's kids that play in the playground and stuff. And it was kind of an autumnal period when I wrote the song. For me, it's like the long hot summer's come to an end. And I sense that with the times we're living in, that we've had the long hot summer and that we're now entering autumn where things...
Times of the end.
Times of the end. I'm not putting any names and dates and all that, but the season, you know, that's what I sense. And I wonder if the elastic band isn't stretching so far as well with things going on in the world, culturally, morally, politically, economically, spiritually, you know, and at the point at which it'll break, you know, and there's a kind of sadness. I always get sad about this time of year anyway, the end of summer and beginning of autumn, but also relating it spiritually, you know, to the times as well, from a prophetic perspective as well, you know.
The leaves are turning and start to fall. Long days are a slow departing friend. The clocks keep ticking, but they're winding down. The long hot summer's coming to an end. But everybody knows, it's
Well, I love the way you use that sadness, which is, you know, part of human life. That's just the way it is. That's the human condition. But you use that for the good, to point out that actually we don't need to be sad about this because of Christ, because of the existence of God who wants to have this relationship with us. And you, I mean, I'm coming back to another one of these songs, which seems, you know, very sad on the surface, unless you get the message you're really trying to bring across, which is The Small Dash. I love that song. And that line that you have, which I think is very cleverly written, the small dash between the numbers on the gravestone, that's you.
Yeah.
I mean, that is really sad. I mean, that really always hurts to hear that. And yet, of course, you're not saying that life is ultimately meaningless, that life is just this very small span and that's it, you're over. You're not saying that. You're saying that if that is, I presume this is what you're saying anyway, if that is the way you look at reality, then of course you're going to have no hope and you're going to feel sad about it. But come to your senses, there really is a message of hope that's in Christ. I love the way you do that with that line. You sort of combine these elements so economically in the lyrics. You know, you take that lifespan sign there on the gravestone and you use that little jot to point out the pointlessness of our lives without Christ. I mean, I think that's brilliant.
Well, I've been to a lot of funerals over the last few years. Where I work, mental health, been quite a lot of funerals. You know, a lot of people I work with or know, get to know, who die prematurely. A lot of suicides, all sorts of things. I've been to good funerals and bad funerals. I know that's a weird thing to say, but you can tell a good one and a not so good one. But it amazes me. It's a shocking, horrifying thing to think how quickly people are forgotten. Anyway, what's for supper? You know, kind of thing, you know, get on with life, you know. And that's the truth. That'll be the case for you, for me, for Mel. So really, the small dash between the numbers is just to take stock of how short life is, longer or shorter, because some of those distances are slightly longer and some are shorter. I mean, I work in a lot of graveyards. I know you're going to think that's weird, but I'm always hanging around graveyards, you know. So. But in my probation job, we clean up graveyards, so we go and sort them out and things. And sometimes we use jet wash to clean some of them down. And so obviously you're suddenly spraying away the moss and then you see the small dash between the numbers, you know. And I'm with a lot of these guys, and often the conversations we have are about the shortness of life. And
But I do think with this song, the climax of what you say comes later on in the song, which is don't waste your life. And then it says waste your life, lose your life, don't
right.
you? And that's pointing towards the sun on the horizon. So, it's pointing towards Jesus.
So Jesus said, the one who loses his life shall gain its life. Yes. What does he mean by that? Yes. You know, yes. Is he being clever? He's saying that real life is to pour out your life, is to lose your life, give up striving, ambition, all the things that you've got to plan, and give up your life to him, because he is the life. He is the one who has a claim on your life. But he offers you, and this is the thing, he gave up his life. Now, he is the Son of God. He is the creator of the universe, all things made by him, for him, through him. And if there's any one person who could say, well, I'm going to live my life, it could be him. It should be him. But he actually offers it up and says, I'm going to pour out my life.
As indeed Satan did tempt him to.
Satan offered him that.
To claim the kingdoms of the world, which in fact did belong to him, but it wasn't the right time.
And I love that about Jesus, because it's love. He's obedient to the will of the Father. He doesn't have to be, because he's the one who made the rules and then subjects himself to the rules. And we don't. We go our own way, and we're like Aleister Crowley or whatever, whoever, you know, do what thou wilt. He's not do what thou wilt. He's I'll do my Father's will. And that's why he says, pray your will be done on earth. And he even says, let us pray. You know, he's involved with us. He's kind of like associating himself with us at the same time as with his Father. I mean, this is why Jesus is the just man that Plato was looking for. And who is the just man? Where is he? And then in Revelation, you've got the one who steps forward, who can break the seals. He is just, he's the answer, you know, the one who's got it all. He's got the character. He's got the CV. He's done it as well. He hasn't just talked about it. And so that to me is the fantastic thing. So to pour out your life in that song, we're saying don't waste your life. Don't waste your life. Oh yeah, don't waste it. Waste it. Waste your life. Put all your plans and all your thing and all your life. It's so important. Waste it. Throw it on the altar. Throw it to Jesus and give it to him. And you know what? Yes. To gain your life. And you'll gain it.
And the other point being is that, you know, you think, oh, that might cost me a bit. That's, oh, don't know. The point is everybody's pouring out their life on something. So that's a given. Everybody is pouring their life out
right
on something.
That's true, yeah. Isn't it? Whatever you're doing, if you're a pop star, you're pouring your life out for whatever you have to do that day and, that, and your career and everything, throwing everything at it.
Mark Bolan last night and looked at that, didn't we?
If you're a drug addict, you are pouring your life out for your next hit, for your heroin. Your life was poured out to that, yeah? So every scenario, you know, you're doing it, you know.
Small dash between the numbers on the gravestone. A small dash between the numbers on the gravestone. That's you. You were building, always building for something you'd never see. You were working, always working for somebody else's dream. There's a bandstand in the garden where the music used to play. People laughing, people singing. They were playing their lover's games. They were living in the moment. Couldn't feel time pass away. Only spiders and weeds are all that now remain.
Well, again, this is one of the things I love about this song is that you have all this teaching there of Jesus embedded in the song, and yet you don't mention him, which I think is just excellent because it opens up the audience to your message a lot more than I think if you'd mentioned him throughout, I think you'd have turned a lot of people off.
Yeah, that's the nature of it. And it's true. Well, truth is truth, and the words of Jesus, I understand it's Christianese, isn't it? It's funny, actually, sometimes when I try and write words with Jesus in, I don't like it. It doesn't seem to kind of fit. It just seems... try it. I mean, you know.
Well, this is one of the reasons why people use Yeshua, isn't it? Because it breaks away from that standard oral experience that people have as a kind of switch off in their minds.
Yeah.
And also Yahweh. I like to use all different names for God because it describes him in different ways, in different contexts, how he's appearing, Hashem or something different.
Lord. It's about getting past those. We read a book many years ago called Past Watchful Dragons. Was it by Walter Hooper or something, the associate of C.S. Lewis?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
And in fact, you'd written a song about it, going past the watchful dragons, the sentries that are set up in our minds that make us block off certain ideas once we hear the word or whatever it may be. And it's about getting past those watchful dragons. And, I mean, if you think about Jesus himself, he could have preached all the time on deep theological truths about his father's kingdom and so on and so forth. But actually, he spoke a lot in parables, and he spoke in ways that didn't mention the word Yahweh, for example, or whatever it might be. Yes. He told stories that nevertheless conveyed the truth. So, yeah, appreciative of that kind of way of doing things.
Indeed. So, mm-hmm. so that those who don't want to hear will not hear, and those who do want to hear will hear.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Because you said that before about the way you actually structure your songs, you're doing a similar kind of thing.
The ears that hear, exactly.
And because this whole sort of Hebrew element, we've just been talking about Yeshua and Yahweh, etc. This is very much a big thing with your songs, isn't it? Because you have very definitely Hebrew style songs, Jewish sounding songs in your albums. I think you've got three, is it, or even four here. You've got Wait for the City, we talk about the New Jerusalem. You've got Run to the Mountains, of course, about Jesus teaching of in Matthew 24 about the coming judgment, etc. etc. You've got Where Are You Going? Each of these has a sort of Jewish bouncy kind of sound to it, and I think you're even using Jewish scales there, aren't you? That was it, altered religion or whatever it's called, something like that. Anyway, with those, is that again, you're trying to ground what you're saying in the gospel as something that comes out of the Hebrew religion? Are you trying to take it away from the switch off phrases and things of modernity and ground it back where it came from?
Maybe.
It may be. I don't know.
I wonder why you're doing it.
You know? Are you a psychiatrist, a musical psychiatrist?
Yes.
Because you may be right. You may be right. But it's kind of I think it's almost more intuitive with us. Like the Wait for the Lord one is something that it was a song that God gave me, the basics of it, many years ago, almost as a personal worship song. And it's been developed by, you know, Andy and the band.
Which one was it? Wait for the City? Was that the one?
Yeah, that one. I think we've always had this instinctive spiritual affinity with some of that Hebraic music, because when we've encountered messianic music, it just stirs something in my spirit lets my spirit be free to worship. It just resonates a lot more with me than maybe certain hymns or whatever. So it's just in us, I think, that we just love that sort of music, like, and the chords just come.
I suppose you're right. It is obviously much more the roots of Jesus was Jew, apostles were Jewish, Christianity is Jewish. You know, it's quite hard to... I think was it Hitler who tried to create his own form of Christianity, and he set the task of removing all the Jewish references, and I think he left with like three pages or something.
It's hopeless, wasn't it? Yes.
So, I mean, you know, as a Gentile grafted in, it's just really enjoyable. And I just love the music. I just like it. I just like kind of Middle Eastern sounding music. I just really always have. Since I discovered it.
And it's quite fun to combine it in a hybrid fashion with a sort of Lou Reed influence.
Well, I was thinking of Gary Newman, actually, with the Wait for the City. With the City of Adonai coming out of the sky, it sounded like Gary Newman at that point.
Not wrong.
I'll have to have more of this kind of musical on the psychiatrist bench stuff. I need to be there. I've got issues.
Oh,
Well, now you've brought that up, I'm going to press you on this, because you brought up Matador, and I was thinking, what on earth is this about? I must admit, I have not quite understood this one. Is it to do with this whole anti-Christian culture that seems to be growing up and the groupthink associated with that? Have I got that right?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
It's really just about the nature of conversation and the games that are played, rather like a matador, and how you have the crowd watching, and the matador's got the bull in this situation, he's playing with it, very much like Jesus was really amongst his enemies, and they're trying to catch him out, you know, where they're asking questions, and they don't want to know the answer. They're not questions they're asking where they want the truth. They're questions they're asking to trap him. Who should we pay our taxes to? You know, blah, blah, blah. Caesar all got, you know, all this kind of stuff. And he answers correctly and he does the right thing. And then also there's the time when he keeps his mouth shut, you know, when he's before the authorities and they say, oh, who prophesied, you know, and they spit him and hit him and stuff. I prophesy who hit you and all this kind of stuff. And he's like a lamb. And so I find it amazing that God, who could answer and just deal with his enemies and deal with those who are trying to trap him, but he allows himself to be the bull. He allows himself to be the lamb. He's the lion that is a lamb. And it's in light of actually reading Plato and Cicero and stuff like this and learning the art of clever talk. It was something you had to learn, like a gladiator learned his skills. And you're playing to an audience like a prosecutor will play to the jury, framing questions in a certain way. And this is what Jesus went into. He went into, you know, what does it say in Psalm 22? You know, I'm surrounded by bulls of Bashan, dogs and lions. They surround me, you know, and they look at me and they jeer at me and they stick their tongues out as they stare. And, you know, Jesus allowed himself to be in that situation. And as Christians, we find it as well. We get asked questions.
This is why I said what I said to begin with. Is it about the anti-Christian culture? But you're actually...
Yeah, well, there is that.
You're saying that centrally this is about Jesus and his experience, but it does reflect onto the experience of the Christian both in that time and now as well.
Yeah, this is the nature of the enemy, Lucifer, Satan, the Nakash. He plays these games. He's a clever talker, charismatic, very good at coming across and pulling the wool over those who are watching. It's all about doing it in front of an audience. He knows the game. The person who's doing it to knows the game. He doesn't look at the audience, but he knows they're watching and he knows how to get them manipulated.
It's the art of persuasion and you know, the idea of being in a law court. You could have an absolutely excellent lawyer who will persuade the jury with his clever words, but actually it's not the truth. And you may be convicting an innocent person or vice versa.
They can be very convincing arguments, but they're still not the truth.
They can be, but they needn't necessarily be. I mean, the reason why I connected with this is because I'm often in conversation with people on my YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the games that certain of the, I suppose they would be sort of new atheist types, only certain of them, but they, you know, they stand out because they play this game very strongly sometimes. They don't want to listen to what you have to say. They are throwing out these sort of pseudo questions to try and trap you. And, you know, once you've made a certain kind of response, that they've got you, you know, and they feel like they're on the side of the right, but it is very much a game. And I've tried, you know, to say, look, I'm going to answer one point at a time. You know, you structure what you're saying properly and then we can have a decent conversation. I often find that those conversations then peter out because they're not interested actually in finding out what you think. They're not really interested in having a logical conversation. They just want to win and they'll do anything to win. You know, some of these people, I think, have that sense that they are riding the spirit of the age. And so they are the intelligent ones who really know what's what. And so they have that confidence that everybody's with them and they can speak from that position. And you do feel, I do feel sometimes that I'm on the back foot with that. And so I have to be very careful. So that's why I was connecting with that. And that, there was something that happened in the media recently with, actually, of all people, the MP, Jacob Rees-Mogg. I don't know whether you came across that.
Right, yeah.
I'm no huge fan of the man, you know, in terms of his politics, but he was on Good Morning Britain or something, one of these ITV chat shows, and he was on there and he'd been brought on there, and it was Piers Morgan and Susanna Reid who were talking to him, and they brought up same-sex marriage and abortion.
Of course.
And, you know, it was done in order to trap him. And I actually think he performed extremely well. He gave his reasons. Obviously, he's a Catholic, so I don't quite agree with the reasons that he gave. But, you know, from his own point of view, he was very rational and considered and measured. But the reaction, I mean, somebody wrote an article in The Guardian absolutely lambasting him because he just didn't say the liberal kinds of things you're supposed to say. And I think it was completely unfair to the man. You know, I think he really did react very well. As I say, although I would disagree with him in, you know, in a number of ways, but that's not the point, you know. You know,
no,
so
bang,
there
bang
is
on.
A Christian in that context, and he is not being treated fairly, and the people who are speaking to him don't actually want to understand his position. They're just rolling the eyes at him, pronouncing him a guilty man in front of everybody else, and it's unfair. So, you know, that did connect with me there. So it isn't just about Jesus, as you say, although it is primarily about his experience, it's also the experience of those who follow him.
Yeah, it's about standing up for those who are being persecuted or slandered or, as you say, misrepresented in some way. Mm. Tim Farrell's another one, isn't
he? Tim Farron, yeah.
Who has been misrepresented and pinned down the way you wouldn't pin down. I don't see all the politicians being pinned down, asked to make some sort of specific stance on same-sex marriage or homosexuality and things like that.
You're not allowed to believe anything, are you? You know, you're not allowed to have your own thoughts. Yeah. It's not enough to say, well, this is not going to influence policy. That's a different matter. This is my personal view. Oh, that's not good enough. You're not even allowed to think in a different way.
Yeah, they've got their spears out and they intend to get the bull, really, and bring him down.
Piers Morgan's a classic example of the kind of matador. He'll get the bull in the ring and then absolutely lambast it, won't allow it to finish one sentence. You know, it's like, come on in and sit down and we're just going to destroy you. You know? We're going to call your name, say this, this, this. And you've really got to be really, really strong.
We do have to be increasingly careful. I think that's true.
Yeah.
And if we're going to have those kinds of conversations, I think we need to set the ground rules, don't we? You know, we actually have to, you know, say if you're going to have a conversation, like I was trying to do, and I think it has worked, actually, you know, I'm going to answer one question at a time if it's a genuine question.
Well, I've found that as well. Recently, I've decided to do that. People have said about the old, you know, they come out with Dawkins-isms, you know, about the Old Testament. Yeah. And I say, look, do you want a proper conversation about this? Do you want to discuss what the Bible is, who it was written to, why it was written, that it's a tribal context and this? Or not? Do you want to? And I said, well, let's move on then. Let's not discuss it. And it actually kind of jolts people. They kind of realize, oh, you know, they kind of have respect for it because for the Bible suddenly, because a lot of these games are played. Yeah. A lot of people have read Dawkins's book, God Delusion. And so they just parrot what he says. They've never read
it. Which is a really bad book, actually. It really is.
Terrible.
It's full of specious arguments. Incredible. Anybody takes it really seriously.
Yeah. I mean, just the basis of what faith is. I mean, you know, I talk to people about it. He doesn't even understand what faith is. No. You know, and I have to start from the basics. And usually people are sitting down on a chair when I'm talking to them. I say, well, you're sitting on a chair right now and you're trusting in that chair to have the ability to withhold your weight. That's trust. That's kind of faith. So let's just define what trust is and what faith is. Dawkins doesn't even understand that. So
no, he just says it's just a blind stab in the dark, as if you just go sitting in a dark room, not knowing there's anything under you at all.
Yeah, that's it.
Crazy.
Crazy, absolutely.
I think it's a worse book than Bertrand Russell's Why I'm Not a Christian. I thought that was a fairly bad book for such a good thinker, such a great thinker.
Yeah.
I've not read that, but it sounds interesting.
Oh, it is interesting, He's a great mind, but you can see that his mind is closed in certain areas, and you're thinking, oh, if you had the same openness that you had with respect to your general philosophical arguments, then, you know, it would have been a different book.
If you're doing it in the name of openness,
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
But another angle is that the matador wants the glory and wants to look good as well, and that's why we got that, you know, like when Apollo killed the python and then took to flight in his suit of lights. You know, mythologically, that's he killed the python. And I think that Satan wants to kill Satan in front of everybody and make out God's evil and whatever. But I think there's a lot of evidence in the myths that the destruction of the Leviathan, I think that the enemy, the fallen one, is going to, in the last days, when
come out as the Messiah,
as the conqueror, who destroys the evil.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, it's like a setup.
That must be true, because that's the essence of the Antichrist, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
He'll destroy Israel's enemies or something, and then everyone will go, oh, yeah, great. He must be. He's of God. You know, he can make war, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, the ultimate deception. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So. I mean, bringing up these sort of mythological aspects, and I don't mean myth in the sense of fairy tale. I mean, you know, myth in the sense of religious teaching, deep symbolism, and all this kind of thing. You do in your song Only One Name actually bring up something of the divine council theology that Dr. Mike Heiser talks about. Very interesting stuff, actually. I do think that is really interesting. Why did you do that? Because, I mean, a lot of people will not pick up on that because you don't say much about it, but it is in there. I mean, the line, it's all the rebel gods bow down when they see the king, the son of man upon the clouds among the Elohim. Now, unless people had some familiarity with that, they wouldn't know, they wouldn't understand that at all, would they? You know, what on earth is the Elohim, you know? So why did you do it in that veiled way?
Just because I think it's true. You can say God's God, Jesus is Savior, but I like to put it in more context. And the context is that, you know, when we say heaven sees things and the man sees things, these are witnesses and testimonies before heaven and earth. I don't think it just means the place and the earth. I think it means the beings and the subjects of those different areas of existence. And I believe that there are, as the Bible teaches, divine beings, angels, cherubim, seraphim, archangels, and there are some that have fallen that are rebels. I just wanted to frame it because I find it so dynamic that the object of all things will be Jesus, and even the enemy, Satan himself, must confess that he is Lord Jesus.
Sure.
I mean, it's really a song about idolatry, isn't it? You know, if you're placing your faith in these other gods, these other things, these statues of stone and everything, they won't be able to deliver. The only one true God is the one who does deliver. He is the Saviour. He is the God of gods. That's why he won't even limit, he won't even patronise himself by giving himself a name as such. He just, you know, when he reveals himself to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, he's El, and even when he reveals himself to Moses, you know, I am who I am sort of thing, you know, and we call it Yahweh, but it's not his name as such, other than the definition of it being I am who I am, you know, that's not really a name.
So he hasn't got a name in a way, really, because he doesn't need one, because he's God.
And yet, because he's so supreme, he is the, you know, and you've got this cosmic mountain imagery, all these other rebel gods have their own cosmic mountains. He doesn't have to claim for himself, even physically, the highest mountain in the world. Because who he is supreme anyway. He doesn't have to battle it out with these lesser beings who are trying to claim that they're equal with him. There is no equal.
But what amazes me is that even though he is the great high God who created the universe, stretched out the heavens, he chooses to be involved and to actually take on these lesser things and enter into the battle. I like that. It's amazing. Why does he doesn't need to do that? And even all the things that, you know, creating a new tribe called Israel, having a priestly system, having a tabernacle, then having a temple. He decides to do that, to teach us something, to teaching mechanism.
Yeah.
He doesn't need that.
I think it's true to say that very often he's using the language of the people at a particular time in order to convey his truth to them. So people in the ancient world did do sacrifice, you know. So God will use that and say, well, I want to turn that to my purposes, to teach you.
That's right.
So the very bulls and other animals that you're sacrificing, well, no, you sacrifice them to me.
That's right.
Doesn't mean that he is actually bloodthirsty. Mm-hmm. He's speaking the language of the ancient people.
Yeah.
And that's just a very simple change you can make in your mind about how you read scripture and just think, wait a minute. Okay, so everyone's doing this anyway. I mean, I tend to think of it this way. Think of the Jewish nation as pagans that are being Yahwehized.
Yes.
So they're already pagan. They're thinking like pagans. So he has to work with that. You know,
that's right.
It's not just about to give him a science lesson on the shape of the earth or anything like that. He's got to start.
Don't go down that one.
No.
Sorry. Yeah, go on.
What on flat earth are you talking about? No.
Oh, no, man. You haven't, have you? You haven't gone down that road.
I'm going. I've gone. Ah! Oh, no, yeah. Don't worry. I'm back.
I've upset that contingent.
I keep meeting people who have gone. And it's like, come back. No, please. Bye. Anyway, moving on.
Anyway, going back to that, the Michael Heiser stuff there, we've talked about, you know, gods a number of times there.
Yes.
Obviously, anybody who's interested in pursuing that, go to the Naked Bible podcast and listen to what Mike Heiser actually says about this. But my understanding of this is it's gods in the sense of false gods that other peoples are worshipping, etc. But also this term Elohim, which gets translated as God in the Old Testament. But here, this is the idea of this divine council of beings who share some spiritual dimension with the one true God.
It's an address, isn't it?
Yes, indeed.
The postcode.
Yeah, the divine postcode, what a thought. So these are gods with a small g,
yeah,
but not really God in the full theistic sense that we normally think of as God with a full g.
No, they're not creators.
They're part of the council.
They were made, and,
yes, indeed. And God is, with the big g, is the head of the council.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one can think that this is polytheism, but it's not, is it?
No, these aren't gods in the sense of creators. No. And also the fact that some of the fallen ones were given authority, I mean, they may not have been fallen at the time, but that some of the divine beings were given in the Table of Nations, were given Deuteronomy 32, according to the numbers of the sons of God, 70, the nations were divided after the Tower of Babel.
So the sons of God here are the Elohim.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, this is a whole other subject in its own right, so yeah. But I do repeat that the Naked Bible podcast series is the place to go. I'll obviously put that in the show notes.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm wondering what your last song is going to be in your list, because I don't know whether you've finalised it yet, have you?
No.
Is it going to be Where Are You Going? Is that where you're going to end?
Yeah, yeah.
I thought you might.
We finish our gigs on that song.
Mm-hmm. Now, this, as I said before, this is one of sort of Hebrew-sounding ones again, but you have the sound of a, well, it sounds to me like a balalaika, a strumming, sustaining sound. Is there a Jewish version of it, or is it the balalaika?
It's neither. It's just Tom's guitar. But yeah, we love that dulcimer or that balalaika sound. I love that kind of sound. But I love all those kind of.
And has the theremin been used once or twice in any of these?
Only when my nose needed cleaning.
But you're not making a deliberate Russian Jewish connection there in the song.
No,
just the sound of it.
Just the sound of it. Sorry about that, man. Oh, that would have been good.
Oh no, I just wondered. They are psychology, musical psychologists again. And in that song, you do one of the things which is often considered to be an unacceptable thing to do, which is to talk about the blood. No, will his blood wash you whole? And of course, people very often these days say, well, you mustn't use that kind of language because people won't understand it. But if you contextualize it, which I think you do in this song, and of course, in the whole album, then I think it's actually very effective to retain those kinds of biblical phrases. I presume you agree with that. Do you, however, think that in general, talking to people, that it probably is a good idea not to use that kind of language? You don't go up to somebody and say, are you washed in the blood of the Lamb, brother?
I guess there's occasionally a time to say it, because in my coming to know, believe in Jesus and become a Christian, there was one guy, I was in Detroit, and I was staying overnight in some kind of disused nunnery, lying on the floor. I remember it really clearly because it smelt of orange fabric cleaner or something. Anyway, so it sticks in your head. And this guy came up to me and he went, have your sins been washed in the blood of the Lamb? And I was like, are you being serious? You know, do you mean it? I wasn't sure if he'd pretend to be a televangelist or something, or whether he meant it or not. Yep. And I'll never know, but it made me think.
Well, yeah, so it did actually work in a way, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of nutty things like that have really made me think. So, yeah, I know what you mean. It doesn't make any sense, really.
I think it's...
Without context, it doesn't.
Out of context,
But as I say, in the album, there clearly is context. So anybody who's thinking about it will understand what's going on, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could say it as a conversation opener and say, let me explain what I mean.
Yeah.
But you're right, actually, because in modern way of thinking, sacrifices and covering and forgiveness for sins and stuff, you know, you first of all have to start talking about morality and what do you think's right and wrong. And it's very interesting. I was chatting to a guy the other day on probation and spent most of his life in prison, in and out of prisons, very clear thinker and stuff. But he was the law to himself. He admitted it. He says, you know, our laws are just, everything's just relative. What's right to you, what's wrong is right to you, and what's right to me is relative, and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, you have to start in a kind of C.S. Lewis way and say, well, okay, so if I stole something off you, you'd appeal to a law of like, that's not fair, that's wrong. So you have to try and get people right down to the basics of working out if there is a common right and wrong for everyone. You'd be surprised how many people don't even think there is. So you have to start, like you say, talking about, have your sins been washed in the blood of the Lamb, isn't going to really be good, is it, talking to people who don't even think there's such thing as right and wrong.
Yeah, it reminds me of, again, we talked about Schaefer before. I think he had some example of asking some student, I think, who was saying, you know, well, there's no difference between right and wrong. And he did something like holding a kettle of boiling water over the chap's head and said, can you just say that again?
Well, I remember Brian Godawa did a really good short story thing where this bloke was a lecturer. He was lecturing the students at university saying, you know, there's no such thing as moral absolutes or anything like that, you know. And one of his students kidnapped him, took him back to his, like, garage and tied him up, and then he's got this blowtorch out, and he's like, you just start like that. And the guy's going, no, don't do it. He says, but you told me there were no moral absolutes. And it just ends with the torch coming on, and it ends, and you think, oh, you know.
Oh, dear, yeah. It's like a scene from Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, that kind of thing. I heard another pastor story where it was in Russia, and this guy was an atheist and teaching everyone about evolution and saying, you know, there's no difference between you and that chair over there. You're all meaningless. We've always evolved from pond scum. There's no purpose to anything, kind of atheism. And this student stood up and picked the chair up and threw it at him.
Yeah.
And he got and the tutor got really cross. He said, why are you getting cross? There's no difference between the chair and you. You know, made the point straight away. You know.
Yeah, you've got to cut through it sometimes, haven't you? Yeah. Mm. So is your album is now finished but not finally mixed?
No.
And you haven't got the order absolutely sorted, although you know what your last song is.
Yeah, it's pretty much sorted.
And your cover?
Cupboard sorted.
I was sent this rather... Oh, have you stayed with the one that was sent to me of this? Looks like somebody dressed as an animal with a poster in the middle of the traffic. Is that right?
It's a Spider-Man suit with a standard tiger head, just standing in the middle of Broad Street in Birmingham with a dissident prophet. Well, you know, you see these guys advertising pizza everywhere, don't you? You know, I don't know if you get them where you are, but, you know, wearing...
I have seen them, yes.
A cheap superhero thing in the freezing cold, standing out in the rain, you know, advertising cheap Domino's pizzas. So... Yeah. Adrian, our friend, he designed a kind of Domino's logo for us. And so we thought, well, tell you what, we'll go and advertise Dissident Prophet. It looks like we're advertising pizza, but we're advertising Dissident Prophet.
It's excellent, actually.
Always like the idea. There's a Larry Norman album called Only Visiting This Planet. And I really like a picture of him standing in the middle of the highway with cars going either way of him, looking a bit bemused. And I just thought, no, I can see. It'd be great to have a superhero standing there, kind of like fed up, looking at his phone, advertising something, pizza in the middle of the street, you know.
Was that you dressed up?
It's my son.
Oh, right.
It's actually my son, Joe. He wanted to do it. He was desperate. We did pay him in pizza, so that's all right.
Oh, well, thanks very much, Mel Nadi, for coming on. I said, actually, at some point, if you upset me, I was going to call you Andrew, but you never did, in fact. You never did, and I presume I would have said Melanie as well, but neither of you got to my goat, so well done for that.
I'd never do that.
I'd
never do that to you, Charles. Never do that.
Thanks, Andrew. Yep, there you go. That's how that started, isn't it? You said it on Facebook. That's right. Oh, dear. Well, thanks ever so much, both of you, for coming on. I'm sorry that I'm not on top form, but that's just the way it is. My voice has been kicking off recently, and I'm dosed up with ibuprofen. It does tend to sort of dull my mind, but that's just the way things go.
It's great.
So thank you ever so much. It has been great speaking to you, and it'll be wonderful to intersperse some of our, you know, so these tracks into our conversation here. And I do hope that people will go and listen to the whole thing when it comes out in a couple of weeks or so from now by visiting your Bandcamp page, which I shall link to, of course, in the notes. So do keep checking that page for the album launch. A great album, as always. Well done. Really enjoyable.
Okay, bro. Well,
thanks.
It's been
great talk, haven't we?
Yeah, total pleasure.
It's been nice to hook up with you.
Yeah, thanks, man. Appreciate it.
I look forward to the hard CD.
Yes, we'll get the hard one, hard copies going, and T-shirts and videos and
tea towels
and mugs and tea towels. Yeah, we want to do tea towels with it.
I've never had a tea towel from you before.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is new, is it?
Mm-hmm. We want to do a tea towel with Dissident Prophet on it, because I think tea towels are just great things to have, aren't they? And we put them on the snare drum anyway, so to record it, so may as well have a proper one. So.
What about doormats?
Oh no, we don't want people wiping their feet on our name, do we?
Well, I've had a good idea.
Well, Oswald Chambers said you need to be a doormat for Christ.
Oh, we should. Oh, maybe we should then. Yeah.
Right. Do you know what I was thinking? I know it's a bit off the subject, but I had this idea of, you know, Dragon's Den, you know, going on those ideas and stuff. And I was thinking, why not actually produce like little carpets, little rugs that you just sweep the rubbish under?
Oh yeah, yeah.
No one's ever thought of that, you know. It sweeps up under the carpet. I mean, it could be Dissident Prophet one. Anyway, never mind.
Why not? Yeah, well, you heard it here first. If you ever bring those out, there'll be a link to that as well. Okay, well, thanks ever so much, both of you. It's great to speak to you.
Okay, bro. Well, we'll speak to you soon. See you soon.
Yeah, bye.
Where are you going? Do you know? Do you care? This world is shaking. Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you lost and alone? Do you need to find your home? Where are you going? Do you know? Where are you going? Do you know? Can you tell?